KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Almost 100 days into the Trump administration, authorities arrested more than 100 people in a nightclub. What does the incident say about the drive for mass deportation? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The United Nations says its food warehouses in Gaza are empty after Israel blocked aid. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We hear this hour from Gaza. Kitchens are shutting down, and what food remains is too expensive for most to afford. We also have tips for reducing financial stress, and millions must tune in to witness migrating moose. It's Monday, April 28th. On this day in 2001, Dennis Tito rode a Russian spaceship and spent about a week at the International Space Station after paying $20 million, the first space tourist. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russia says it will implement a unilateral temporary ceasefire running from May 8th to May 10th. Russia is going to mark the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. It's calling on Ukraine to follow suit, but this comes after Russia declared a ceasefire for Easter. Both Russia and Ukraine blamed each other for breaking that truce. The news comes after President Trump met Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky over the weekend at the Vatican. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Ukraine.
The two men met at the Vatican before attending the funeral of Pope Francis. Oleksandr Merezhko, who is a lawmaker with Zelensky's party, says the meeting gives him hope.
There is nothing like direct face-to-face dialogue between both presidents, because this is the only way how all misunderstandings can be removed.
However, the Trump administration has been pressing Ukraine to accommodate Russian demands and is offering very little to Ukraine in return. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
There's been widespread immigration raids in recent days in Colorado and Miami. Over the weekend, federal authorities say they detained at least 100 migrants in the U.S. illegally. Officials say these arrests came at an underground club. White House press spokesperson Caroline Levitt says that as the president approaches 100 days in office, he will take even more strong action to stem illegal immigration.
President Trump will sign an executive order on law and order and another executive order on sanctuary cities. The first EO will strengthen and unleash America's law enforcement to pursue criminals and protect innocent citizens. The second EO is centered around protecting American communities from criminal aliens, and it will direct the Attorney General and Secretary of Homeland Security to publish a list of state and local jurisdictions that obstruct the enforcement of federal immigration laws.
Meanwhile, officials have put dozens of posters on the White House lawn today. These are mugshots of people the administration says are illegally in the U.S. Stocks open mixed this morning as investors prepare for a report card on the nation's economy later this week. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 100 points in early trading.
The Commerce Department will report this week on first quarter GDP growth. Forecasters expect the report will show the economy grew more slowly in the first 3 months of the year than in the final months of last year. Both consumers and businesses have had their confidence rattled by President Trump's trade war. We'll also get a report this week on how the job market held up in April, as many of the president's new import taxes went into effect. Some nervous customers are cutting back on pizza orders. Domino's Pizza says sales at U.S. restaurants slowed in February and March. The news took a bite out of the company's stock price, but the world's largest pizza chain was helped by stronger sales outside the U.S. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up 120 points. This is NPR. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments this week in a case involving Catholic charter schools. At issue is whether they can be directly funded by taxpayers. As Beth Wallace reports from Tulsa, the case is from Oklahoma.
On Wednesday, the High Court will hear oral arguments for Oklahoma Statewide Charter School Board v. Drummond. The question is the St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School a public school and therefore prohibited from receiving direct public funds for its religious education, or a private government contractor that has a right to the free exercise of religion? Rachel Lazar, president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, says a decision in St. Isidore's favor would be a philosophical sea change.
I'll quote Thomas Jefferson, that it's sinful and tyrannical to require a man to fund a religion that's not his own.
A decision in the case is expected by the summer. For NPR News, I'm Beth Wallace in Tulsa.
There's a massive power outage underway in much of Spain and parts of Portugal and France. Traffic lights are out, banking services are down, and elected officials are telling people to stay put. The head of the electricity grid in Spain says restoring power could take several more hours. The airports in Spain and Portugal's capitals are in the dark. Officials in Iran say at least 40 people have been killed after a massive explosion Saturday night at one of Iran's largest shipping ports. More than 800 people are injured. It's unclear what triggered the blast. It started a major fire. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Trump administration is restoring the records of international students in an important government database, and we'll tell you why that matters. But first,
almost 100 days into the Trump administration, we have a chance to check in on one of the president's signature goals.
Yes, the president promised mass deportations, as many as a million people per year. It's hard to judge how they're doing, but one outside analysis gives some perspective. The Migration Policy Institute estimates that the number of arrests is up, but the pace of deportations is, so far, down from the last fiscal year under President Biden.
There have been some high-profile cases, of course, including one over the weekend. Federal authorities say they arrested more than 100 people at an underground nightclub in Colorado Springs. People authorities say lacked legal status. NPR's Joel Rose has been following all of this. Joel, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
What happened in the nightclub?
The Drug Enforcement Administration shared video and details about this raid that took place at what the DEA called an underground nightclub in Colorado Springs in the early morning hours of Sunday. The DEA says several hundred people were in the club at the time, including 114 immigrants without legal status who were arrested. And if true, this would be one of the largest single enforcement actions since President Trump took office. Attorney General Pam Bondi said in a social media post on Sunday that the club was, quote, frequented by TDA and MS-13 terrorists, unquote, which is apparently a reference to Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan gang that the administration has recently designated as a foreign terrorist organization. NPR could not immediately verify the legal status of those who were arrested or whether there's any evidence of gang membership, though authorities also said that they recovered drugs and guns from this raid.
Okay, so that is one case that has developed over the weekend. I want to ask you about another one in recent days. We're told that a 2-year-old American citizen was deported last week. What happened?
Yeah, this involves a family in New Orleans. The mother does not have legal status, but her 2-year-old daughter, who was born in Louisiana, is a U.S. citizen. The mother was going to her regular check-in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement last week, according to a lawsuit filed by her attorney, when she and her two children were detained. Her lawyer says immigration authorities held her and her children without allowing them to speak with anyone. Even her partner, the children's father, was only able to speak to her for less than a minute before the mother and two children were deported to Honduras. The judge in this case, who was appointed by President Trump, seems concerned about how this was handled, and he has now set a hearing for next month with the goal of dispelling his, quote, strong suspicion that the government just deported a U.S. citizen with no meaningful process, unquote. According to the ACLU, this is one of three U.S. children deported from the U.S., along with mothers without legal status last week.
Well, what has the administration said?
Tom Homan, the White House border czar, was asked about these cases this morning at a White House press briefing, and he framed this as a parental decision.
What we did is remove children with their mothers who requested the children depart with them. This was a parental decision. And I tell you what, if we didn't do it, the story today would be Trump administration separating families again. No, we're keeping families together.
But critics say these families did not have a meaningful chance to make major decisions about their children's futures. They say the administration is in such a rush to drive up deportation numbers to make good on President Trump's promise that the administration is making mistakes and deporting people with no criminal records, and in some cases, deporting very young U.S. citizens.
Well, how popular is all of this?
To some extent, that depends on the poll. There's a CBS YouGov poll that shows 56% of Americans approve of President Trump's program to deport immigrants in the country illegally. Another Washington Post ABC Ipsos poll, though, found that only 46% now approve of Trump's handling of immigration, 53% disapprove.
NPR's Joel Rose with an update on almost 100 days of Trump's immigration policy. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The Department of Homeland Security is restoring the records of international students in an important immigration database, the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System, or SEVIS. Without an entry in the database, international students can't easily adjust or extend their legal status, meaning many would likely have been forced to leave the country even if they were still in good standing at their school, about to graduate, or had reasonable grounds to argue for staying. Over the past few weeks, it seems that students with misdemeanors or dismissed charges were the ones notified that they were affected. In some cases, they were told they'd be deported. Judges in more than 50 cases had issued orders for the government to bring back those records in SEVIS. On Friday, the DOJ announced in federal court it had or will restore those records. Those students now seem to have a reprieve, but the administration says it will come up with a new policy for student visa holders. Alora Mukherjee is a professor and director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. She's been talking with some of those students, and she's going to talk with us now. Good morning, Professor. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Michelle.
So let me run some of this reporting by you. Have you seen a pattern in who's been affected by this database issue? Because it's been reported in some outlets that focus on higher ed that the students who've been getting these notifications seem to come mainly from the Middle East, from majority Muslim countries, and with some kind of infraction, like, say, a traffic ticket. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes. What I'm seeing is that a large proportion of the students who are affected are from countries in the Middle East, from Asia, and increasingly from Africa. In what we've seen is that students who are affected have very minor criminal histories or nothing at all. And when I say very minor, I'm referring to things like traffic violations, parking violations, or students who literally have no idea what they have done wrong. They've never even received a summons.
So you're saying some of these are what we would call low-level offenses, but you have seen students that have, in your view, or at least in your understanding, have no criminal involvement at all.
That's right.
And is this mainly, we've been hearing a lot from like elite schools like Columbia and Harvard and efforts to kind of evaluate the student populations there. Is it mainly these kinds of highly visible schools, or are there others from what you understand?
Not at all. More than 280 colleges and universities have been affected by these SEVIS terminations, and the SEVIS terminations have taken place in at least 23 states. So it's large, high-profile institutions as well as much smaller public institutions that are being affected by SEVIS terminations.
I can imagine that this is very upsetting.
It is terrifying for international students across the country. Many have told me that they're losing sleep over this. They're missing classes. They're terrified to leave their apartments because they're worried they'll be arrested. At least five students have even left the country voluntarily after finding out that their termination has been taken place.
Let's just say for the sake of argument, okay? I don't know this to be true, but let's say for the sake of argument that you have a student with a low-level, say, criminal offense. Maybe they got into a bar fight or something of that sort, or a serious traffic accident.
maybe they've been notified. But what about students who have not had an experience like that? Are they also concerned?
Yes, absolutely. The Sevis terminations in the recent weeks have created a sense of deep unsettlement, deep fear across many international students, regardless of whether they've been personally affected by these terminations. Now, many are wondering, even if they've done nothing wrong, whether they'll be able to complete their degree programs in the United States and stay here without the risk of being deported.
So let's say that, for the sake of argument again, that at least some of these students have had some sort of involvement, interaction, perhaps a low-level criminal offense, okay? What would you say to those who say, well, if that's the case, then, you know, these visa or enrollment spots should go to other people? If you're going to study here, then you should keep a clean record and avoid these kinds of experiences. What would you say to that?
I would say that the U.S. Constitution and our laws apply to all people on U.S. soil. The federal government, the executive branch, must not simply terminate people's status without any due process of law, in violation of the law, the regulations, and basic due process.
And before we let you go, as briefly as you can, do you think that the country risks something if international students leave or just stop coming?
Yes. Right now, the United States attracts the best and brightest, most talented minds from around the world, and our country will lose out if there is deep uncertainty about whether international students can finish their programs in our country.
That's Professor Alora Mukherjee. She directs the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. Professor, thanks so much for sharing these insights.
Thank you for having me.
Moose are on the move in Sweden, and millions of people are watching. NPR's Ayanna Archie reports on what's called slow TV.
From late April to late May, hundreds of moose move from their winter hangout by the Bothnian Bay to their summer one near the Sweden-Norway border. Swedish public broadcaster SVT has live-streamed the journey since 2019. More than 9 million people watched across the globe last year, and viewership is expected to be even higher this year, according to an executive producer. The coverage switches camera shots between various wooded areas in the Ungerman River. Much of the footage is mooseless. Birds, trees, and bears. But every now and then, antlers peek above the surface of the water or through the trees, and their six-foot silhouettes emerge.
In the summer, they migrate to good places where they can birth the calves, and good places where they can find good food.
That was Joran Eriksson of the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences. He also told NPR moose in northern Sweden migrate up to 56 miles, much longer than moose in southern Sweden. The journey takes a couple of weeks, give or take, just in time for the nutrients to mature in the vegetation they enjoy, like bilberries and Scots pine. Their trek is also influenced by climate. They're more likely to leave if there's a lot of snow. But over the years, human activity has changed their routes.
It's been affected by development of hydroelectric power, which created dams. That has created sometimes ice conditions that are not favorable, because when we use electricity, we use more water and then the ice gets thinner. It also has been impacted by forestry and by the development of roads.
The live stream success is an indication of how popular the slow TV genre has become. Slow TV is live, unedited, and hours-long coverage of some routine event, like a cross-country train route or people knitting. It was pioneered by NRK, Norway's public broadcasting service. And now it's a global phenomenon.
The enormous impact this show has received from North America, Asia, New Zealand, you name it. For some reason, this is really caught on for people. They like the tranquility, they like the uniqueness of the landscape, and discover a lot of things they didn't know before.
Ayanna Archie, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with author and executive Daria Burke. She'll talk about her new memoir, Of My Own Making, which explores her growing up in 1980s Detroit amid addiction and instability, and the years she spent trying to outrun that past by building a carefully curated, outwardly successful life. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The UN says it has no more food in Gaza. Its warehouses are now empty, and it cannot supply charity kitchens that had been feeding a million people, half of Gaza's population. Israel has blocked food and aid for 2 months. Dozens of countries are arguing at The Hague today that the blockade violates international law. NPR's Anas Baba in Gaza City and Aya Batraoui in Dubai report on the desperate search for food.
Desperate crowds of children and adults push and shove at a charity kitchen in Gaza City. They hold out metal pots and empty food cans for scoops of whatever's been cooked. These days, it's mostly lentils. Majda Assakani, a 50-year-old mother, showed up hoping for some rice to feed her 8 children.
I swear to God, we sleep hungry. I'm a witness to this. We go hungry. We don't have dinner or breakfast, just this meal for lunch, and the portion isn't even enough.
The UN World Food Program has been warning for weeks supplies in Gaza are running out. A month ago, its 25 bakeries in Gaza shut down because there was no more flour or cooking gas under Israel's blockade. In this video, the UN Food Agency shows the last boxes of food aid being loaded onto trucks. The World Food Program's Antoine Renard says supplies in Gaza are fully depleted.
Our remaining stocks were directed to Hot Meal Kitchen, which are continuing to serve people in need. But these too are expected to run out by the end of the month.
That means food kitchens that rely on the World Food Program will shut down within days. But there's enough food to feed a million people for months just waiting outside Gaza. Israel is blocking it from coming in. Israeli hardliners say it's how to win the war against Hamas and free hostages held in Gaza on Israel's terms. Israeli lawmaker Moshe Sada of the Prime Minister's Likud party told Israel's Channel 14 News last week, "I do want to starve the Gazans. Yes, absolutely. It is our duty." Hamas condemns the blockade. Rights groups and aid organizations say Israel's blockade amounts to collective punishment and is illegal under international law. Back at the food kitchen, waiting in a crowd of hundreds, Assakani says there will be famine when these kitchens close. We only have God and this food kitchen, she says. She only has prayers when this lifeline for her and her 8 kids ends within days. There are some markets selling food, but there's no dairy, eggs, or poultry. Just canned corned beef, fermented pickles, and locally grown vegetables. Most people can't afford to buy even these. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with Anas Baba in Gaza City.
A lot of people are dealing with financial stress at the moment. Tens of thousands of federal employees are losing their jobs. People are scared to look at their retirement portfolios, and others are fretting about a possible recession and layoffs. There is research suggesting there are things people can do to protect their mental health during financial crises. NPR's Katie Riddle is here to tell us all about it. So you've been reporting on the mental health impacts of job loss for federal workers. What have you found?
One thing that I've heard from a lot of these folks is that jobs become part of their identity. Many of the federal workers I've spoken with have trained for years in their field and have worked in them for a long time, in some cases decades. Federal work is public service, so the chance to make a difference is meaningful to people. Here's one woman I talked to. She asked only to be identified by her middle name, Michelle. She's concerned that by speaking out, she could jeopardize the severance money she's still receiving from the CDC. That's where she worked before she was fired.
The work and the mission is something that I'm really mourning the loss of. I think both for myself, I'm just like really heartbroken for what this means for our country and the safety of the people in it.
Michelle was doing work on preventing child sex trafficking, and she's not confident that work will go on now since her whole team was cut. You can hear the grief in her voice. She's not at all sure that she'll be able to find another job in this field. So she's having to reconcile with losing a piece of herself.
Yeah, she said mourning the loss of the work and the mission. I mean, that's rough. I mean, what does the research tell us about overcoming this kind of loss?
There is some evidence that suggests that the worst thing people can do is nothing. One thing that Michelle told me is that she has a couple of side hustles going. They don't pay a lot, but the research shows that it's those kinds of things that get you back in the workforce sooner and help you to move through that grief and start reimagining yourself, figuring out who you're going to be if it's not this person you thought you were.
So you're saying in the face of economic uncertainty, try not to freak out about money.
I mean, I don't want to imply that money doesn't make a difference. It certainly matters. If you can't pay the mortgage or get food on the table, that is a real crisis. But how you deal with this crisis can make it better or worse. One person I talked to is Jeffrey Anvari Clark. He's a professor of social work at the University of North Dakota.
If a person loses their income, then they get depressed, then they have a difficult time, you know, either looking for work or being able to interview well and to secure that new employment. And then they have bigger bills that are now mounting. So everything can spiral as a result.
He says how you grapple with these circumstances can matter more than how much money you actually have. He says people who become paralyzed by uncertainty or depression are just much worse off.
So then how do you not become paralyzed? Because, I mean, once you're there, I mean, it's hard to get out.
Yeah, I mean, he is not saying this is easy. It is very hard. Research shows that job loss can have real impacts on people's mental and physical health. Sometimes just forcing yourself to go through the motions, dusting off the resume, reaching out to professional contacts, those things help mitigate this risk. And then simple things like getting enough sleep, exercise, maintaining social connections, all really make a difference in how well you can move through a setback like this. You know, the research shows that people who have the best outcomes in these situations are the ones who are the most resilient, who keep engaging with the world in some capacity and are willing to try new things, think of themselves in new ways. The more you can tackle these things head on, the better off you'll be.
That's NPR's Katie Riddle. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
This is NPR News.
After college, deaf students are less likely to find jobs in the sciences, healthcare, or teaching, and government grants that aim to change that were just ended by the Trump administration.
I definitely feel like if things had been different, I wouldn't be feeling so lost and unsure about my future.
I'm Ari Shapiro. The uncertainty ahead for students on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan is due back in court in Wisconsin next month for a preliminary hearing. She was arrested by the FBI last week, accused of helping a man in the U.S. without legal status of evading immigration authorities in her courtroom. It's something she denies. One Democratic state lawmaker, Ryan Clancy, says he supports Dugan and questions why immigration authorities were even at the courthouse.
They absolutely should not be going into courtrooms. That has a chilling effect both on people that are there to participate and also elected and appointed officials like judges who are clearly being targeted by this administration.
Clancy was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. This is Election Day in Canada, where voters are deciding whether interim Prime Minister Mark Carney should be elected to a full term. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Mark Carney, the new leader of the Liberal Party, has tried to convince Canadians that he is the best man to lead the country as it faces a trade war with President Trump, as well as rhetoric about Canada becoming the 51st state. The Conservatives, under Pierre Poilievre, have tried to widen the campaign issues to include affordability and an appeal to Canadians not to give the Liberals a fourth term in office. The two key battlegrounds to watch will be vote-rich Ontario and British Columbia. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
This is NPR News. Russia will observe a three-day ceasefire with Ukraine May 8th through 10th. Russian President Vladimir Putin says his forces will halt hostilities in observance of the end of World War II 80 years ago. The White House continues to pressure Moscow to accept a U.S. peace proposal. President Trump met with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky briefly over the weekend ahead of the Pope's funeral. President Trump marks his first 100 days of the second term in office this week. Education Secretary Linda McMahon will be doing so today with a trip to Louisiana, as Aubrey Juhas with member station WWNO explains.
McMahon is scheduled to tour a public middle school in Baton Rouge, alongside Louisiana's Superintendent of Education, Cade Brumley. They plan to visit classrooms and hold a roundtable discussion on the state's recent growth in reading scores. Louisiana's fourth graders led the country in reading gains again last year. In 2019, the group ranked 50th in the country for reading. Now they're 16th. And students are scoring higher than they did before the pandemic. Brumley said in a statement that he's honored to welcome McMahon. He's publicly supported many of the Trump administration's education policies, including dismantling the U.S. Department of Education. For NPR News, I'm Aubrey Juhas in New Orleans.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Let's get an assessment of an explosion at an Iranian seaport. Photos show shipping containers crushed like cans in a cloud of black smoke. State media say this blast killed at least 40 people and injured more. People trying to figure this out include Trita Parsi, who is executive vice president at the Quincy Institute, which in its own words favors military restraint and diplomatic engagement. He focuses on Iran. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
What sources are you consulting and what do they tell you?
Well, I've been talking to folks inside of Iran as well as following news there, and the picture remains divided. It's not entirely clear exactly what happened and whether this was an accident or whether it was an act of sabotage. Now, of course, you had several explosions with certain distance between them that seems to lend itself to be better explained by an act of sabotage rather than an accident. But again, at this point, we still don't know exactly what happened.
Yeah, I guess from official sources so far through state media, we've mainly heard what they say did not happen more than what did. They've said that this was not related to refineries, fuel tanks, or oil pipelines, according to the National Oil Company. They've said this had nothing to do with Iran's defense sector. It did seem to have something to do with, quote, hazardous goods, but we don't know more than that. Does this make you think at all about Iran's infrastructure, though? Last year, Iran's president was in a helicopter that crashed and killed him, turned out to be an accident. Could we be seeing further signs of infrastructure that's decaying in Iran?
Certainly, and I don't think that's been a mystery at all, given more than 40 years of sanctions on the country. It's been quite clear that the infrastructure is in very poor shape. Iran has one of the highest rates of airline crashes as well. So that in itself is clear. What's added to the picture, of course, is that this is happening in the background of very sensitive nuclear talks between the United States and Iran. In fact, this explosion happened just as the Iranian foreign minister and Witkoff were meeting not far away from there in the country of Oman.
You've been an advocate of U.S. engagement with Iran over the years and a supporter of the nuclear deal that the United States made and President Trump pulled out of years ago. Trump clearly hasn't been a fan in the same way of engagement, but here the Trump administration is talking directly with Iran. What do you make of that action?
Well, I think he's come to the conclusion that at the end of the day, something needs to be done to make sure that there isn't an Iranian nuclear weapon, and something needs to be done in order to make sure that there isn't war between the United States and Iran. And negotiations and a verification-based deal is ultimately the best guarantee that exists to make sure that both of those very negative outcomes are avoided.
When you study the statements on the Iranian side, do you detect any real willingness for a deal on any terms the United States could accept?
The willingness for a deal on the Iranian side, I would say, is the strongest I've ever seen, including when the Iranians did agree to a deal with Obama in 2015. There is an upside with Trump that the Iranians see that I don't think they saw with Biden, for instance, which is that they know that the willingness from the U.S. side to actually offer much more and much more sustained sanctions relief is far greater with Trump. So there's a clear willingness there. And at the same time, Trump has insisted that his only red line is nuclear weapons, which then creates a common denominator between the two sides, since the Iranians say that they don't want a nuclear weapon. What complicates it is if the United States were to adopt the Israeli position, which is that there's a complete dismantlement of the program, zero enrichment. That's where we know that there will be a tremendous amount of differences and probably no negotiations at all.
In a few seconds, why do you think it is the Trump administration would be in a position to offer greater sanctions relief than Biden was?
Because Trump is willing to put primary sanctions on the table, which are the sanctions that are targeting American companies. The Iranian nuclear deal from 2015 only lifted the sanctions that were prohibiting non-American companies from going into the Iranian market.
Got it. Trita, thanks so much for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case about the federal laws that promise help for children with disabilities in public schools. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Ava Tharp is a teenage girl who suffers from serious disabilities caused by a rare form of epilepsy. She needs assistance with everyday tasks like walking and using the toilet. And she has so many seizures, most during the morning, that her public school in Kentucky arranged her schedule to be in the afternoon only, including a teacher giving her instruction at home in the early evening. But when her family moved to Minnesota for her father's job, Ava's new school in the Twin Cities refused to accommodate her late day schedule. As a result, her school time hours were reduced to 65% of what her peers received. Ava and her parents sued the Osseo Area School System, claiming that it failed to live up to the requirements specified under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Rehabilitation Act, and the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act, the IDEA. Those three federal laws mandate, in part, that schools receiving federal funds must provide reasonable accommodations for kids with disabilities. A state administrative law judge sided with Ava's parents, finding that the school district's reasons for denying her a full day of instruction were, quote, not credible. After multiple years of litigation, the school district did provide Ava with comprehensive schooling under the IDEA, but her parents sought compensatory damages for the money they had to spend on outside specialists and teachers for Ava during the years prior to the school district's granting her the help she needed. Those compensatory damages are not permitted under the IDEA, but they are under the other two federal statutes that protect the rights of people with disabilities. The lower courts are split on the question of what parents must prove in order to qualify for those compensatory damages. In many parts of the country, including the federal appeals court that covers Minnesota, parents must clear a very high bar to qualify, making it nigh unto impossible for parents to prevail. Here's Ava's father, Aaron Tharp.
If we're successful before the Supreme Court and we can change the standard, we'll be able to help all these other families across the country for them to be able to help their disabled children get what they should be getting under the law.
In all, five federal appeals courts have established that very strict standard for parents to qualify for compensatory damages. They must show that the school district acted in, quote, bad faith or with, quote, gross misjudgment. But two other appeals courts have established a less stringent standard that demands only a showing of, quote, deliberate indifference by the school system. Which standard is the right one? That's the question before the justices today. Disability rights groups are on Ava's side, but the Osseo Area School District counters that if Ava wins, school systems would be, quote, on the hook for potentially crushing liability. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. In tumultuous times, our go-to book expert Tracy Thomas turns to poet Lucille Clifton and Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison. We'll find out why next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. A man in England had his car stolen, so he found a replacement, same year in color. When he got it home, he saw other similarities. Christmas tree pines in the trunk, just like his. Candy wrappers lying around, just like his. His parents' address in the GPS. He'd bought back his old car for more than 20 grand. Police told him the thieves were pros at tampering with a vehicle identification number, but couldn't they have cleaned up first? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. President Trump has changed what he's saying about the tariffs he put in place against China, suggesting they might come down from 145%. But as of now, they're still in force. Now, a lot of different kinds of businesses have been affected by this trade war, but businesses in Chinatowns have been hit especially hard since many of them rely on Chinese imports. Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman from member station KQED brings us the view from San Francisco's Chinatown.
By all appearances, it's a normal day here in Chinatown. Street performers busk for tips, tour guides lead groups through the narrow, brick-lined alleyways, and Bay Area locals get their grocery shopping done. Daniel Young lives in Antioch and comes here to buy Chinese products he can't get anywhere else.
Today I bought some chips and a whole bunch of fortune cookies. I even got a giant one for my daughter for her birthday.
He says he's noticed that some items are more expensive than they used to be. He chalks that up to the tariffs imposed by the Trump administration.
It's kind of like trying to start a war, you know? I don't understand why he would want to do that only to China.
Mei Zhu owns the store where Young was shopping. She says the vast majority of her products are imported from China. Soy sauce, dry noodles, candies, and cookies. According to Zhu, wholesalers have absorbed some of the price hikes, so she's only had to raise her prices by around 50%. But other items now cost a full 145% more, so she's stopped stocking them. It is extremely significant, she says. The higher prices are driving customers away, and sales are down 30%. She says it's already impossible to continue, and if the tariffs stay in place, she'll close her business. Down the street at Yongfeng Highway Chinese Herbal, Sam Leung presides over a store full of things like goji berries and ginseng and other products used in traditional Chinese medicine. He says you can get some of these things outside of China, but they may not be exactly what his Chinese customers want. And he's worried the increase in prices will put them out of reach for his customers. These Chinatown businesses are facing an existential threat, according to Malcolm Young.
This has always been a community built around trade.
He's the executive director of the Chinatown Community Development Center. He says for over a century, Chinese immigrants here have leveraged their connections back in China to build successful businesses and achieve their American dream. The tariffs are changing that.
You're basically just sending the signal, like, that's off, that's done.
He says San Francisco's Chinatown has been around since the 1800s and has withstood all kinds of hardship. The Chinese Exclusion Act, the 1906 earthquake, and more recently, COVID and a local increase of anti-Asian hate crimes. Still, with this particular challenge, he says there's an emerging sense of powerlessness.
That these things are being done to us and that there's nothing, you know, we can do as a community to push back or fight back, but just to simply react.
He expects that other Chinatowns across the country will be experiencing the same kind of economic upheaval. Price hikes are also being reported in Chinatowns in New York, Philadelphia, and Honolulu. For NPR News, I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman in San Francisco.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
It has been a long 100 days.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Mercury. Mercury offers banking and financial software to help businesses do more in one place. Learn more at mercury.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Tomorrow marks 100 days of President Trump's second term in office. We're taking a look this week at what this new administration has meant for the U.S. and world economies in that time. We start today with Zanny Minton-Bedos. She's the editor-in-chief of The Economist magazine. She spoke with my colleague David Brancaccio.
A central beat of your magazine over 180 years has been freer trade. So I guess, Zanny, you've lived to see it, the trade revolution before our eyes. I mean, I think you used the word. It is a revolution?
It is a revolution. It's a revolution actually beyond trade. But on the economic side, this administration has imposed the biggest tariff hike probably in history. The IMF came out with its latest projections for growth just a few days ago, and they dramatically downgraded growth expectations for the United States. And the same is true of pretty much every bank. Everyone is expecting the U.S. to slow sharply, perhaps even hit a recession. And this is entirely self-induced.
The administration tends to suddenly pivot on some of these crucial points of policy. Do you think this revolution is so ingrained now that it's gonna stick?
So I think there is going to be a huge amount of uncertainty about that, because you are seeing that when the markets react very, very badly, President Trump appears to pull back. But I think this is a president who really believes in tariffs. And because we don't really know what the end goal is, and you have a president who changes his mind, it seems, very frequently, I think the main thing that we can predict with some certainty is that we're going to be in for an incredibly uncertain period.
I have been advancing a thesis here for quite a few weeks. Tell me if I'm wrong. Beyond America's legal system, the courts, it seems like the bond market and maybe the stock market, they're the last remaining check on executive power in America.
Well, it's interesting. They are certainly, particularly the bond markets, playing a role as a check. And to have simultaneously equity prices fall, bond yields rise, bond prices fall, and the dollar fall is a combination that you don't usually see in the United States. And that combination is something you usually see in a kind of weak emerging economy where investors suddenly lose confidence in the credibility of that economy completely and just want to get out of every asset that economy has. And the really worrying thing right now in the last few weeks is that we've seen some hints that investors are having that attitude shift to the U.S. And about a third of U.S. treasuries are held by foreigners. And if foreigners basically think brand USA is damaged and they move out en masse, that means we could have a very serious financial crisis on top of slower growth and recession.
Zanny Minton-Bedos, editor-in-chief of The Economist. Always good to catch up.
Thank you.
Minton-Bedos was speaking there with Marketplace's David Brancaccio. All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 133 points. That's 0.3%. The S&P 500 is pretty much flat. The NASDAQ is down 0.3%. And the yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.24%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing direct car insurance rates side by side with other insurance carriers. Customers can see rates and find an option that works for their needs. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com.
President Trump has promised that once the U.S. gets through a period of short-term pain from tariffs, once we're on the other side of that, these taxes will usher in a golden age of U.S. manufacturing. But the thing is, this is not a new idea. The world has been here before many times, it turns out. So how did that work out in the past? Paul Krugman is here to talk about that. He's a professor of economics at the City University of New York and a Nobel laureate in economics. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we are not the first country to try and use tariffs to promote development of, you know, homegrown industry. President Trump's not the first leader to promise prosperity through tariffs. Where else have we seen this in history?
You can go back to 19th century America, 19th century Germany. Many developing countries tried to industrialize with tariffs in the sort of 35 years that followed World War II. There's a lot of evidence on this, though nobody has ever imposed tariffs this big, this fast, as we're now seeing from Trump.
Well, in the cases where it has been tried before, I guess on a smaller scale, in Latin America after World War II and Africa after World War II, how did it work out for them?
Well, yeah, Trump likes to talk about 19th century America, but if we look at the experience of tariff-driven industrialization in the post-war world, it's pretty bad. By and large, countries abandoned that approach in the 1980s because it hadn't panned out. It produced some manufacturing, yeah, but it was inefficient, it was uncompetitive, it wasn't the root, and it turned out that more open economies that were oriented towards world markets, performed better than countries that tried to build manufacturing by looking inwards.
Because I think to a lot of people, it probably sounds intuitively correct that, oh yeah, sure, let's protect our domestic industry, let's just make more stuff here. Why did it not work out in the cases where it was tried?
First of all, manufacturing, you know, it's not as if most countries most of the time have lots of spare labor, lots of spare resources. If you are going to build up manufacturing behind tariff walls, it's going to divert resources away from other uses. And then the question is this going to be a good use of workers, good use of capital or not? And if you try to only produce stuff for yourself, if you forego the benefits of international trade, then that industry is inefficient. You're producing things you really shouldn't be producing. And you end up producing stuff also at inefficiently small scales. You end up with low efficiency because you fragmented the industry.
Is there a way to make it work? And the reason why I ask that is because, you know, Korea, China, they seem to have used a certain amount of trade barriers along with other tools. And they took their economies, you know, from 10 to 100 in just a few decades. Is there a way to do it?
To the extent that they have done stuff, it has tended to be, yeah, there are tariffs, but the really important tools have been industrial policy, has been subsidizing, promoting industries, which can work if you can figure out the industries that have positive spillovers to the rest of the economy.
Paul Krugman, professor of economics at City University of New York, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Our producers are Meredith Gerritsen-Morby, Ariana Rosas, Stephen Ryan, Alex Schroeder, Erica Soderstrom, and Jared Dang. And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.